Last year, if you were part of Real Life last Christmas season, you know that we were part of a grassroots movement called Advent Conspiracy. And I know it's not even Thanksgiving yet, and some of you are thinking, Christmas? Come on, dude. We're not going to be spending how many weeks talking about Christmas, are we? No, we're not. But last year, a lot of you told me that you wish we could have started talking about these ideas of Advent Conspiracy a little bit earlier in the year, because many of you plan months ahead into Christmas. And so I thought we'd talk about it now, even though I know Christmas is still a ways away yet. But as we start to gear up for the holidays, this is, you know, next couple weeks is when you're going to start thinking about it. I'm hoping that this will be just some seeds that we can plant in your head, that maybe you could just, you know, kind of rethink some of the things that we do at Christmas time. And here's how it all began. A couple years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, three pastors in the Portland, Oregon area were sitting around, and they were talking about how much it sucks to be a pastor at Christmas time. And many, if you're not a pastor, you might not understand that. And so let me try to explain. You know, normally Christian holidays are fun. They're exciting. They're meaningful, and they're rich. But Advent, you know, is one of those Christian holidays that just is so rich with meaning. It's about God breaking into our world, about God coming down to our level. It's about God showing unspeakable love for us. It's about God's promise. It's about hope. It's about revolutionary love. But we Americans have a way of celebrating it in the most insane sort of ways. We spend billions of dollars on things we really don't need in the first place. And oftentimes, we spend money to make up for a lack of actually giving of ourselves, like Jesus did. And so the Christmas season has turned into, for a lot of us, a season of stress, a season of traffic jams and shopping lists and debt and just insanity. And when it's over, a lot of us are just so relieved that it's finally over. And we're left with looming debt that sometimes takes months to pay off, and this empty feeling that maybe somehow we just missed it along the way. And so these pastors, three pastors in Portland, Oregon area, gathered together, and they said, you know what sucks? Being a pastor at Christmas time. And they said, yeah, it does suck. And they said, what if we could rethink Christmas this year? What would that look like? And they began to imagine what that might look like. And what if Christmas could become a world-changing event again? And what if we could begin to live that revolutionary story of Christmas all over again? You see, when Jesus came, he came to this earth as a king, but he came as a baby. And he really was a threat to the powers that be of his day. King Herod, if you remember the Christmas story, you remember King Herod was freaked out that this baby was born. And the wise men came and said, we came to worship a king. And he said, yes, tell me where he is and I'll worship him too, you know. And, you know, of course, he wants to kill the baby, but he can't find him. And so he kills all the babies under 2 years old. Remember the story, right? Huge sort of scandal that came with Jesus coming into the world. Jesus shows up different than a lot of other kings. He doesn't show up riding a horse or with chariots and armies and in great power. He comes as a baby. And then he grows up to be this homeless itinerant preacher. But yet the powers that be were really threatened by Jesus, ultimately killing him. And so there's this interesting tension that goes on in the Christmas story, and you've probably caught on to that of the powers that be, the most powerful people in the world are threatened by this baby, you know, who comes in complete humility. And so, you know, here we are. We live this story in which we don't really buy into humility and love and simplicity and giving of ourselves, but instead we sort of buy into this patriotic idea of supporting the empire, kind of almost the exact opposite. In fact, we Americans have this kind of funny thing I've noticed in recent years, and I think it started after September 11th, that we think it's our patriotic duty to shop. Yeah, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I remember after September 11th, you know, they were saying, well, you know, the whole world seems to be coming apart. What can we do? And so many people said, well, you can shop. And a lot of you didn't need a lot of motivation as it was. You're like, you know, for God and country, I'll do this, you know. And you went to the mall and you maxed up every credit card you had, you know, for for Jesus and for country, I guess. But you know, we have this twisted idea that somehow we wrap spending and consumerism in with patriotism. And so this morning, I want to talk to you a bit about this radical idea. And again, hopefully just plant some seeds in your mind about what you're going to do this Christmas and how you're going to celebrate this Christmas season. Because really, as you know, the season really begins like right after Thanksgiving. And so we're coming right up on this. And again, how are we going to think about Christmas this year? So these three pastors gathered in Portland, Oregon. They're talking about this. They're processing this idea. And they said, what if we did it a little different this year? What if instead of focusing on all that stuff, all the peripheral sorts of things, we really began to focus on Jesus? And so the first thing about Advent conspiracy is that that we worship fully. We worship fully. And so Christmas is first and foremost a time to worship. Christmas starts and ends with Jesus. It's a time when we put down our burdens and we lift up a song to God. It's a season where love wins, where peace reigns, and where we celebrate God's kingdom coming to earth. It's really this time in which we step back and we realize and reflect that God is close. He's closer than we realize, and he's a lot closer than we think. And that he has entered into our world, not just 2,000 years ago, but he continues to enter into your world and my world today. And while that sometimes may seem like, well, big deal, I mean, think about really what the deepest things that our souls long for really is just the presence of another human being or the presence of God. Now, think of it this way. When you were dating, or maybe right now, you were in a long-distance relationship. And if you've ever been in a long-distance relationship, you know what I'm talking about. You know, you call the other person, or you send pictures or emails or mementos and telephone calls, whatever it may be. You try to sort of kindle that relationship, but when they live 1,000 miles away or 500 miles away or whatever it is, it's hard to really connect. There's really nothing there's nothing that takes the place of just being with somebody. And even like when we're sick, if you've had the flu or pneumonia or whatever, what you want from other people is not so much soothing words as just them being there with you. And so this is the main idea of Christmas, is that God has entered into our world, into our space, into where you and I live. That God is not some distant, far-off sort of concept, unconcerned with you and me, but he has entered into our world. And we get this really in sort of an ancient way. They would express a person's character a lot of times by the names in which they would call some people. So as you read through the Bible, you got to pay attention to the names that people are called, because they're really significant. And unlike our day, we'll name our kids after our rich uncle or something, hoping that we might, get something in the will or something. But back in the ancient world, it was different. They oftentimes, a person's name reflected their character. So in Matthew's story about the birth of Jesus, he mentions this verse in Isaiah that was written 700 years earlier. He writes in Matthew 1, "All this happened to fulfill the Lord's message through his prophet. Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She'll give birth to a son, and he will be called Emmanuel," meaning God is with us. God is with us. And if you read through Matthew, this becomes a theme that occurs over and over again, that God is with us. God has entered into our world. At the very beginning of Matthew, in the Christmas story, is this theme: God is with us. And it ends at the end of Matthew with this great commission, in which Matthew records these words of the last words of Jesus. The 11 disciples left for Galilee, going to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some of them still doubted. Jesus came and told his disciples these words: "I've been given complete authority in heaven and earth. There, go forth and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I've given you." And then these are the last recorded words of Jesus in Matthew's gospel. "And be sure of this, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." For Matthew, the heart of Christmas is that God is with us. He is with us. God comes in the world as this sort of medicine, as this cure. And by entering into our broken world, he's inserting his medicine into the entire human race. And he becomes this healing agent for you and for me, So Isaiah says his name will be Emmanuel. That doesn't mean that that's what they're going to call him. That means that this is the character of who he is. This is the reputation that he carries, that God is with us. Not God is with Jesus, but God is with us. But of course, we call him Jesus, which comes from the Hebrew word Joshua, Yeshua. And if you're familiar, again, with the Old Testament stories, you know that after the Israelites wandered in the wilderness under Moses' leadership, Moses dies, and then the next leader of the Israelites becomes Yeshua, Joshua, for whom Jesus is named after. And he is the one who is the deliverer, right? The one who takes those who wander in the wilderness, those who have no sense of meaning and purpose, those who are out in the dark place into a land flowing with milk and honey. And Jesus becomes this sort of, again, this is the symbol of who he is for us. God is with us and he is leading us out of darkness into light. God is with us and he is leading us out of the desert into lush pastures. God is with us. And so this is the story of God. This is the story that changes the world. And this is what Advent is really about. But we get caught up in all the other stuff. Truth be told, we're often not worshiping when we come during the Christmas season. We've got so much on our mind. We're thinking about shopping lists and spending and obligatory parties. But Advent conspiracy is this idea that let's rediscover worship first and foremost. Let's refocus Christmas on what it should be about Jesus. And maybe part of the way we do that is the second part of Advent conspiracy, is spending less. And so these three pastors gathered in Portland, Oregon, and said, what if we spent less? What if we spent less this year and reconsidered how we did that? Because we live in this world where that tells us that how important we are is based on how big your paycheck is. Or how important you are is based on what you own or the car that you drive or the house that you live in. And our lives are built around this crazy, insane story that tells us that we need more and more and more stuff. In fact, we have an entire industry in our country devoted to people whose job is nothing more than to get you to be discontent with who you are and what you own so that you will buy what they have. We hire these ad agencies to tell us that, you know, unless you own these things, unless you wear these things, unless you eat these things, unless you put these things in your hair, your lives will be empty and meaningless. And we buy that, and we believe it, because there's something deep inside our souls that starts when we're children, that we know that it's important to know that we matter. I mean, watch kids on a playground in elementary school. Everybody's trying to be somebody. Everybody's trying to be the fastest runner, the best jump roper, or the first one picked for kickball, or whatever it may be. And all of that is just this, an attempt to settle this nagging question inside their little hearts and minds. Am I okay? Do others think I'm okay? And if you roll the video ahead 30 years, you know, the same thing is playing out in many of our lives, in many of our souls, the same messages. I will be somebody if I live in a certain size house, if I live in the right neighborhood, if I wear the clothing with the appropriate labels, if I drive cars with the right insignias and vacation in the right places. But then you find out that you can't do those sorts of things. You can't feel that sense of meaning without spending a whole lot of money. And so we arrange our lives around this insane scramble for more and more so that we feel like a somebody. But what we find is that no matter how much we spend or how much we get, we still feel no different about ourselves than we did on that playground 30 years ago. And it's not long before we feel like Solomon did in Ecclesiastes when he writes these words, "The one who loves money is never satisfied with money, nor the one who loves wealth with big profits." More smoke, he says. It's all meaningless. And then Christmas time rolls around every year. And when it comes to Christmas, we take this same sort of impulse, this insane story of consumerism, and we mix it up with the story of Jesus. And this consumerism story tells us that unless we spend insane amounts of money on people we love, buying things they really don't need, that they really won't love us. And I know some of you are thinking at this point, you know, there's a real biblical basis for giving gifts at Christmas. When the wise men came to visit Jesus, they brought gifts. So therefore, we should follow suit and do the same thing for each other. And I'll give you that. When the wise men came to visit Jesus, they brought gifts. But who did they give the gifts to? They came to Jesus, right? They didn't give them to each other. They didn't say, hey, Bob, here's some frankincense. I brought this for you. Oh, well, thank you, you know, as they're standing around the baby, you know. And Steve, I got you some myrrh. Myrrh, we needed myrrh. Thanks, how did you know? You know, it didn't go like that, did it? No, the gifts were for the baby Jesus, for Jesus himself. So if you're an average American, you will spend between $300 and $1,200 on Christmas this year. On, you know, just average. I think the average amount is like 800 and some change that the average American will spend on Christmas. And my guess is this. If we went around the room and took a little survey, a lot of that money goes to buy gifts for people that you just feel obligated to give. And I imagine that a lot of gifts that you receive were given by people that felt obligated like they should probably give you something. And so these pastors, as they sat around in Portland, Oregon, they said, what if we called just a truce on this insanity? What if we just said stop? What if we just cut back on what we spent? And what if this year we didn't go into debt trying to make everyone happy with stuff they really didn't need in the first place? And again, I know what some of you are thinking. Spending less sounds like Christmas is really going to suck this year, right? Well, let me talk about that, you know? I mean, maybe you're thinking my kids are going to come to me and they're going to say, oh, great, Dad made something for me for Christmas this year. You know, I mean, maybe I'll just sleep in this year Christmas morning, you know, instead of rushing down to see what Dad crocheted for me, you know? And I'll just kind of take it easy. Which brings us to the next thing of Advent conspiracy. It's about Jesus first, and then it's about spending less, but then it's also about giving more. And this is what we mean by this. See, when God wanted to give to the world, he didn't give us a toaster oven, or he didn't give us a gift certificate to Dillard's, or something like that. He gave us something much better than that. He gave us himself. And Isaiah says this, for a child is born to us. A son is given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and he'll be called, again, here's this name thing, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. This is the character. This is the essence of what he's going to be. And what's amazing about this verse is not just the character of who Jesus is or how he's going to change the world, but it shows how Christmas is about giving, but not giving in a twisted consumeristic way. God giving himself to us, giving relationally to us. To us a child is born, to us a son is given. And some of you get this. Some of you grew up in a house where you were bought off. Maybe you had parents who never paid any attention to you. Maybe they were workaholics, they worked all the time. Or maybe you had a parent and that didn't live with you and maybe lived far away and you never really saw them very much. But every Christmas, you know, they'd send you a check for $100. And, you know, it was great and that was all wonderful. But you probably thought to yourself, you know what I'd rather have than this is them. I'd rather just be with them. You'd prefer to have a dad who hung out with you, but instead you got a check. But God's gift to us on Christmas was to give us this relationship, to give us relationally, something built on love. And so it's no wonder that this idea that we're drawn to this idea that Christmas should be a time to love our friends and family in the most memorable ways possible. But what ends up happening is we end up buying relatives things that they don't need in the first place. Get them really mediocre stuff because we really don't have any money to buy them something nice. And so they open it and they're polite. This happens every year with my family every time we gather. Hey, great, socks. Appreciate it. I mean, what do you say, you know? And at some point, you say, somebody's got to just draw a truce. Stop the madness and say, you know, I don't need any more screwdrivers and you don't need any more calendars, all right? We're all going to be fine. Let's just spend the money elsewhere. And so as these pastors gathered, they said, you know, what if we, instead of giving more stuff, we gave more of ourselves? What if we gave more time? Because time is the real gift of Christmas has to offer to us. Time to make gifts that turn into the next family heirloom, for example. And think of it this way, and I know some of you can't do anything with your hands. You're like me. I mean, if you try to make something, you try to fix things, it gets worse, you know. That's the way I am. But think of it this way. You know, when I go home to my parents' house, and I just still kind of blows me away, my parents still have stuff I made in preschool with popsicle sticks and glued together that they have, my dad has on, you know, on his shelf and stuff. What's up with that, you know? I mean, why would he hang on to that? When I bought him a really nice pair of socks last year, you know what I'm saying? But yet he's proud of that. Why is that? Because there was something that was made from the heart, right? So give away popsicle sticks that are glued together this year. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there's something innate about time, that when we spend time on something, it means something more. Time to write a letter to the people we love explaining why we love them. Time to take the kids sledding. Time to bake really good cookies and sing really bad Christmas carols. Time to make things that come from the heart rather than Walmart that came from China. Time gifts that allow us to connect with each other. And think back to your childhood. I mean, think of the most significant memories that you had in your childhood about Christmas, the cherished memories you have. My guess is this. It's not surrounding stuff. It's not about what you got, but it's about the time you spent with significant people in your life. It's about long periods of uninterrupted quality time that you remember, and it shaped your life. And I told you this last year, you know, as we began to think about this last year, thinking about relational giving and what that means. My mother, God bless her, she's got this figured out. If nothing else in life, she's got this figured out. She works for an accounting firm in Salem, Oregon, and every year, she's worked there for about 1,000 years or so, and then every year they give her a Christmas bonus, and every year she takes her Christmas bonus and she says, you know, I could buy you guys a bunch of junk that you're going to forget about, my kids and grandkids, but instead of doing that, she takes that money and she says, I just want us all to gather as a family because this is the one time a year that we can do that and we can spend 4, 5, 6, 7 days together and just have fun together. And so she pays for it all. That's the best part with all her money, you know, and she doesn't really buy us junk. She buys us time. And so we've been all over the country. We've been to San Diego, to Disneyland. We took a cruise in Mexico. We went skiing in Salt Lake City last year. This year, we're going to the Oregon coast, which doesn't sound as fun, but we're going to have a good time anyway. I guess it's the economy and all, you know. But the point is, you know, there's something about time, isn't there? That really the best gifts are not the stuff that you can buy. The best gifts is when we give of ourselves. And we've lost that art. We Americans just have bought into this idea that giving more means spending more, right? But it's not about that. It's about giving of ourselves. And again, don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying, you know, don't spend any money on your kids this year or you're not a Christian. I mean, that's not at all what I'm saying, you know. Don't say to your kids on Christmas morning, you know, kids, I know you wanted that Wii gaming console and all, but I decided instead to crochet you this coaster or something, you know. You know, make sure you send a thank you note to Pastor Dana for that. That would be great. And so I wouldn't appreciate that, by the way. But what I do want you to maybe think about is this. What if this year, what if you and I just began to think about what it would mean to give more of ourselves when we gave? And again, this kind of runs counter to the way in which I've learned anyway how to give. Truth is, we don't know how to do this very well. And so Clayton was kind enough to put together this little thing here. It's Advent Conspiracy Gift Ideas and this little, I guess you call it a brochure. And there's a whole bunch of them out on the table on there on your way out. But these are just ways that Clayton got off the Advent Conspiracy website, ways in which people are thinking, rethinking the way in which we give. How do you give more relationally? How do we give more from the heart? Just because we spend more money doesn't mean that we love more. And so I think in your handout, too, I put the website, rethinkingchristmas.com. Again, it's an Advent conspiracy thing. To help us just, again, rethink this. As you're starting to spend the hundreds of dollars you're going to spend this year, you know, how are you going to do it? How are you going to do it? Because here's the alternative. You know, you can get caught up in all this insanity of Christmas, and you'll keep hearing these messages over and over again that your children will not love you and your spouse will not love you unless you spend profane amounts of money on them. And it's not true. It's not true. And again, just imagine, what if we could give more of ourselves and not just spend large amounts of money on things that people don't need in the first place. I think it might point back to this baby in the manger. That's really the intention of this baby in the manger. So these pastors, they gathered and they said, what if we worshiped first? What if we focused on worship first and then we spent less? And then instead of when we do spend, let's think relationally as we give, giving more relational sorts of gifts. And then what happened was this, and this was sort of the amazing thing. They said, when people spend less, they have this extra money, but instead of just blowing that money, what if we used that to make a difference in the world? And so this brings us to the last point of what these pastors decided to do, to love all, rediscover Christmas, imagine it away from consumeristic world. And again, here's what, just to give you some numbers to frame this in ways that maybe we can understand it. $455 billion Americans spent on Christmas last year. Halloween, a lesser holiday, a minor holiday for most of us. Some of you go nuts with that holiday. $7 billion we Americans spend on candy and decorations and costumes and all the kinds of things. $7 billion. Okay? Now, just think of those numbers, $455 billion, $7 billion. Now, think of this, $20 billion could make a huge dent in the AIDS crisis in Africa, which is the biggest global crisis of our generation, $20 billion. In our world today, 1.6 billion people live without access to clean water. 1.6 billion people. $100 million could get clean water to everyone in the world. Simple as that. And so the question is, you know, where's that money going to come from? So these pastors sat around in Portland, Oregon about 2 years ago, and they said, what if the people who claim the name of Jesus decided that the best way to celebrate Christmas was not with some big consumeristic orgy, but to think about the first Christmas and what it means for God to break into the world and what a revolutionary thing it was. What if we gave away ourselves instead? What if we leveraged our wealth to help out the people that this baby Jesus came to champion? And Jesus was the one who entered into our world and became poor so that you and I could become rich. Paul says it this way in Corinthians, you know the generous grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor so that by his poverty he could make you rich. And so this first Christmas, we learn, was about this sort of redistribution of the wealth, not in this communist way or socialist way, but the way that God entered into the world. God enters into the world of poverty, and he allows us to experience redemption. God, Jesus says, I'm not going to cling on to my status, but I'm laying it down so that the world can be blessed. And we are here today. We are at South Middle School today because of Jesus' willingness to become poor. And so these pastors said, what if we took the money we saved from giving relationally, redistributed it to places of injustice around the world? What would that look like? And so these three pastors took this message back to their congregations. And they said, you know, look, the average person spends between $300 and $1,200 at Christmas. What if we gave to that? And they raised $500,000 to give to dig wells in the poorest parts of the world. Crazy, crazy time. And so last year then, they said, well, let's open this up to some other churches. And that's when we caught wind of it, and we became part of this movement as well. Last year, 1,200 churches participated in this, raised over $3 million to dig wells, water wells, in the poorest parts of the world. And so, you know, this is exactly what I said to you last year, and I'll say it again. There's probably between 400, 450 people who come here on a given weekend, you know, which means there's probably about a little over 1,000 people who think real life is their church home. This is when they come to church, this is where they come. But just say, this is for the sake of numbers, let's say 400 people just took a portion of what they were going to spend this year. $100. 400 times 100. I'm not great at math, but I know that's about 40,000, right? $40,000. That's around 10 water wells in the poorest parts of the world. 10 water wells that could service thousands of people who don't get clean water. And so the question was just wondering, what if we who are rich And you probably don't feel rich. I don't feel rich. But by the world standards, you and I are very rich. Most of us in this room make more than $2 a day. Okay? So, you know, we're pretty rich by the world standards. What if we gave up some of what we spend on Christmas so that we could bless places of injustice? And this is the way I think, and maybe you're different than me. I look at poverty around the world, and it's overwhelming to me. I just think, this is just so huge. The problem is so immense. So many people and so many problems. Where do you even begin? I mean, and I feel kind of paralyzed by it. It's like, don't know where to start. And so part of, if you've been a part of Real Life, you know that in recent months we've been talking about a project called GROW. And GROW, G-R-O, stands for Gisenyi Rwandan Orphans. We're partnering with a church in the town of Gisenyi in the country of Rwanda. And they have, among other things that they do, they have about 800 orphans that they care for. They educate, they train, they give them job skills. And we're partnering with them. And you're going to be hearing more about this as it develops more. But we found six other churches to partner with us in this. And over the next 8 years, our intention is to partner with them, raise about $750,000 over the next year, next 8 years, to do economic development in there. But part of this GROW project is this. One of the first projects that we're doing with them this summer, in fact, there's a church that went out and started this project, and we're going to finish it up this summer. But what happened was there in Gisenyi, the town of Gisenyi, they're up higher in elevation, so they can't dig wells. It's too high, I guess. I don't know anything about digging wells, but apparently if you're high in elevation, you have to dig farther, and it's impractical. So the way in which they collect water is that, well, at this point now they truck it in. They pay top dollar to have fresh water trucked in to their orphanage, and it cost them a ton of money. And so we and our partner churches have been working on a system in which when it rains, we have these collection things. The water runs off the roof into these collection tanks, for lack of a better word. And then they purify the water. They have a filtering system, and that's what they feed the kids with. Because when they run out of water, out of clean water, the kids will drink anything. And when they begin to drink anything, they get all kinds of waterborne illnesses. They miss school. They get sick. They end up having to take them to the doctor. It's just... And waterborne illnesses are disgusting. Look it up on the internet. I was going to show you pictures, but it's just yuck. It's really, really disgusting sort of stuff. And so that's sort of what we thought. We need another. We only need $3,000 to finish this project. It's not a lot of money. And so we thought if we could raise enough to do that, and then we can kind of do some other things as well. So that's sort of the idea that this GROW project was built on, this idea that we can't do everything for everybody. We can't save the entire world, but we can make the world better in one place. We can do that. We can do that for 800 orphans in Gisenyi. We can handle that. Together, we can make a dent for someone. And, you know, again, for me, I even look at those 800 orphans, and that's overwhelming to me. But together, we can do that. Together, we can make a difference. And so last year, I asked a member of our community who's passionate about this issue to spearhead this, and this year, I've asked her to do it again. And, of course, my daughter, Olivia, cares a lot about the continent of Africa and cares a lot about the poor and impoverished in this world. And so I've asked her to come and talk with us a bit about why don't you sit over there, sweetie? What we did last year, and why we've kind of thought about water, and why you can move your chair over. It's okay. Well, let me just ask you this: you know, the people in the Advent conspiracy thing, they've taken on water wells as sort of their project. Why is water wells so expensive, or not expensive? Why is it so important? That's what I'm trying to say. Sorry, Greg. Hello? Test. Did I mess it up? Okay, talk really loud, sweetie.
Okay. So 90% of people who live in extreme poverty, which is people who live on less than $2 a day, don't have access to clean water. And so we could invest in some economic development, but if kids are getting sick from unclean water, then they can't go to school. And if they're getting diarrhea from water, then none of their nutrients from the food they eat are going to go in their body.
Good. So water has become this sort of foundational thing in the developing world. I mean, you could talk about, you know, these people need education, they need, you know, food, they need all these things. But if you can't solve the drinking water problem, then all those other things are sort of useless, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. How many people in the world don't have clean water?
1.8 million.
Billion.
Wait.
Don't have clean water.
Yeah.
Yes.
But 1.9 or 1.8 million kids die a year.
Oh, yes. Yeah. 1.6 billion don't have clean water, but 1.8 million.
Don't. Kids are going to die. Die every year from unclean water. So that'd be 4,900 a day or 3.5 kids a minute, 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Yeah. Should have calculated how many September 11ths that is a day. Yeah. It's a lot. And so it's a huge, huge issue. And of course, you know, with kids are more susceptible to this and to diseases and whatnot. And so this is why it's such a big deal. So last year we partnered with an organization called Rwanda Clean Water, and I think Clayton's showing some pictures of these are actual wells being dug in the country of Rwanda, very similar to the ones in which we built there. Tell us more about Rwanda Clean Water and what we did last year.
Okay, so last year we built about 2 wells. We raised $7,000, and it's $3,000 to build 1 well, and so we provided clean water to people like these, people who live in Rwanda.
Good. And each well serves probably 1,000 people or so. Yeah. So very cool. So this year, what's our hopes this year?
Okay, so this year we're hoping to raise $3,000 to finish a water purification system for the orphans in Gisenyi. And any of the extra money, we're hoping to build some more wells in Rwanda.
With the same organization?
Yeah.
Rwanda Clean Water. Yeah, good. So how can people give to that?
Well, you can put money in the offering, or you can donate online and just mark it as Advent Conspiracy or Grow.
Or if you forget that, put water.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, sweetie. Yeah, so this is a huge deal for a lot of us, I know, and it's a lot to kind of shift and think. And last year when we introduced this, I know a lot of you were like, you know, man, I'm going to make some steps towards this. And I talked with a lot of you that came to me after Christmas and said, this was so helpful. This Christmas was really significant, and told me about the ways in which you tried to give more relationally. And I know, again, a lot of you, you know, we raised over $7,000 last year, just people giving of themselves, you know, and financially, and I think it was a rich time. And so again, don't make this a big legalistic thing. Don't misunderstand me. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, if you celebrate Christmas or give your kids presents, you're not a Christian, you're going to go to hell or something like that. Okay, I mean, don't, you know, but what I hope you get is this: that you enter into this season with a little less insanity than you did last year, and maybe thinking through a little bit more about the way in which we approach Christmas. You know, again, we're not going to be legalistic about this. You know, the Sunday after Christmas, if you show up in a new jacket, we're not going to say, oh, nice jacket, you know. Hope the Rwandan orphans can drink that, you know, or something like that. Unless it's crocheted, then we'll be fine. Then we won't. No, I'm just kidding. That's not true. But again, my hope is this: you'll worship more. You'll begin to focus on the reason of the season. Planning now to focus on the right things. Spending less, and then with what you save from spending less, you know, you give relationally, and you allow God to use your excess to bless the world. It's not complicated, but I think it's reminds me of that first Christmas, the revolutionary nature of that first Christmas in which God enters into the world, and he comes in this revolutionary way. Good news to the poor, good news to the brokenhearted, good news to the people who need it the most. And so that's what I hope we can rediscover again this Christmas. Why don't you pray with me? God in heaven, it's funny how we can take such good things and we can twist them around. It's funny how we can take the gifts that you give us and just kind of pervert them a bit and make them kind of sick. And we just confess that we've kind of done that with Christmas sometimes. Sometimes we've just been kind of caught up on our own consumeristic binge that we've just kind of lost you in the middle of all that. And God, even before we even start this Christmas season, we just want to take pause before the sprint between now and December 25th and say, we just want to enter into the season the right way. We really want to go into it with the right attitude, with the right spirit. We really want this season to be about you and not about us. We really don't want to get caught up in this consumeristic mindset that says that unless we buy more or own more or give more, that we're insignificant. God, teach us again what it means to give more relationally, to give of ourselves. God, allow us to bless the world in the same way that you did when you came to this planet. To bless the world in really the most concrete way possible, with something as simple and as basic as water. May we be a blessing to those who need it desperately. God, I know that as we gather here today, I know that there's people that maybe came to this place feeling that they were just really far from you. And maybe all this talk about how close you really are is maybe surprising to them. Maybe it feels like you're a million miles away to them. But maybe somehow this morning, Lord, they've just sensed your spirit tugging at their heart. Maybe they've sensed your spirit in ways in which they've never experienced before. And so, God, I just pray that they would have the courage to open up their heart to you. Maybe they don't understand it all. Maybe they're just a little uncertain about what this all means, but may they just have the courage to say, God, I don't even know if you're out there. I don't even know what this all means. I don't even know what this might entail, but I open my heart to you. Just come into my life as best as I understand it. Begin to do something new inside of me. May they have the courage to just step out in faith. And God, for all of us, as we get ready to go from this place, we enter into a world that's just as dark as when you came. May we be that light. God, we enter into a world that's just as sick as when you came. And may we be that cure, that remedy, as you were. May we be your hands and feet, your voice in this hurt and broken world. In the name of Jesus, we pray.